Welcome to the Dooldig Studio's Creative Women in Conversation. The Dooldig Studio is a not-for-profit house museum with a gallery and sculpture garden. It is the former home of Slava Horovitz Dooldig and her husband, sculptor Carl Dooldig. The Dooldig Studio holds a nationally significant collection of sculptures, artworks, furniture and archives, which tell the story of this emigre family's journey from Europe via Switzerland and Singapore to Australia. The Dooldig Studio aims to inspire creative journeys through the telling of this story and through its public and education programs. This series of talks is inspired by Slava's inventiveness and interests. Our two creative women in conversation will explore influences, ideas and stories in the creative process. Welcome to Creative Women in Conversation number 2. This week we'll be talking about sculpture. Our two speakers are Leah Justin and Kate Rode. Leah Justin is passionate about contemporary art and is also the co-founder and director, along with her partner Charles, of the Justin Art House Museum. The Justin Art House Museum is both a home and an exhibition space, showcasing the family's permanent collection as well as a curated exhibition twice a year. It's a unique experience and a privilege to view a private collection within a domestic and living environment. Recently rated by Lonely Planet as the top 10 must-dos in Melbourne, I encourage you all to pay a visit. It's well worth it. Kate Rode is also passionate about contemporary art, but she is an art maker. Kate has exhibited extensively Australia-wide and her works are held in some of our top national collections, including the NGV. Kate's work has been described as high baroque, uber-detailed, colourful, bizarre, overwhelming and phantasmagorical. Using mostly resin as a basis for her work, she creates hyper-coloured critters, objects and jewellery and often shows her work in densely packed installations. There's a sense of wonder and enchantment about her work. Her objects stimulate the senses and they raise the eyebrows. Welcome, Leah and Kate.
I think it's fitting that we're in this space that's curated works of Slava, who was an extraordinary modernist artist. She grew up in a time when the secessionist movement was very active in Vienna, and one of the motifs of the secessionist movement was the idea that to every age it's art, and to every art it's freedom. And that movement really tried to break away from historical kind of traditions and try and make a new form, and that's very much part of her mark-making. Your art, as you've alluded to before, is very much, for me, very reminiscent of the Baroque and Rococo kind of influences. And Baroque was very much about the idea that art was to be ornamental and to inspire piety and a great sense of God. And Rococo was almost a reaction to that with its whimsy and its joy. I'm interested to know, because I always think creative people are fascinating, I'm interested to know whether any historical influences have had an influence. And, in fact, what has started the creative journey for you?
Well, look, definitely the Baroque and Rococo movements were very inspiring. I never travelled overseas until I was an adult, and so when I first went to Germany and Austria and sort of saw some of the preserved palaces in Versailles in France, it just blew my mind, really, because you don't really experience that in Australia. So I really was blown out of the water because you see photos of it, it just doesn't really translate the level of, detail and workmanship. And I think one of the other very kind of inspiring things, and I'm very conscious that my uncle is here and I'm going to talk about my family and he may report back to them. So,
and it's being filmed.
My parents built this very... So in the early 80s, they commissioned their sort of grand design, and one of the architects was Japanese, and it was a sort of, I guess, a bit sort of Zen temple or sort of palace, Japanese palace inspired. So it was this very open plan, wooden, angular house, and it was very empty. Like, they never quite got the... you know, furniture. They could never agree on furniture, and my dad sort of obsessed with antiques and my mum hates them, and so you know, and so my dad would constantly try and sneak another, you know, antique sideboard in, and my mum would just kind of complain, and it had gradually sort of moved from the lounge room to the, you know, the back, you know, the back room, and then eventually out. And so sort of grew up in this quite empty house, and we always ended up getting sort of bad temporary furniture to tide us over. And you know, but we're always there, and they've always been renovating. They've never sort of just said, oh, we're done, you know. They just kind of keep adding a bit on or changing a wall. And I mean, part of it is that we were always looking at the architecture magazines. And as a child, I'd flick through and I'd see all these, you know, sort of concepts and finished rooms, you know, finished the interior, you know, sort of done. They'd settled on a, you know, on something. And, you know, and I sort of became interested in how, I guess, how, you know, different rooms can make you sort of feel and think, and that, you know, colours, everything, it has a kind of psychological effect. And
But you've come from the dandelions, you've come from this zen-like kind of space, you've moved almost as a reaction to that. What gave you the... Because I think creativity takes a lot of courage, it takes a lot of curiosity. What gave you the sort of driver to take art school as a direction?
I just didn't really have a better idea, you know. I just sort of liked making things, and I, you know, I just as a child, I'd always drawn, and I'd always been obsessed with detail. Like, it didn't matter what I did, it was always very labor intensive and detailed. And you know, and my parents are tradespeople, so they, you know, they've always worked with their hands as well. So that was the sort of example I grew up with, is that you know, you sort of make things, you do things with your hands. And you know, I finished high school, and I had quite, I'd always loved art, and I did all the art subjects, and despite every, you know, like, my parents never discouraged me. I mean, that was their sort of great sort of thing, was that they, you know, they just wanted me to do what I wanted to do. And I sort of thought, look, I really enjoy art. I'm, you know, I'm young. I've got a, you know, I think I've got a good folio together. I'll go to art school and I can worry about the rest later. You know, I'll just have like 3 or 4 years where I just do something very self-indulgent and then sort of think about a career. So, because I sort of was on the edge between doing, you know, like graphic design or fine arts. And I ended up, I got into both. I could sort of choose. And I thought, look, and I got into VCA, and I felt like that was, you know, something you don't kind of say no to, that you, you know, you follow through with that. And if I'd got into design before, I could do it again. So, yeah, so that was it.
And what did you hope going to art school was going to offer you?
I guess just a real kind of broadening. I mean, my sort of art education up to that point was fairly, you know, quite limited in a way, because I went to quite a nice private school out in the suburbs, but art wasn't really their focus. It was much more sort of sport and academically driven. And to, you know, to go into the city, to go to the National Gallery of Victoria was like a huge, you know, expedition, really. And I mean, I think before I went to uni, I might have been to the, you know, we might go to the city like once a year or twice a year or something, and it seemed like, you know, a big adventure, big holiday. So, you know, just going to the city every day for uni seemed quite, you know, like it just opened my world. And, you know, having all these, you know, learning about all these galleries. And one small thing that was quite lucky was I had a friend who lived up the street from me who'd actually done design and fine art several years before, and could, was a little bit of a mentor, and she knew all the inner city galleries, and her and a friend of hers, they sort of take me to see things. So, you know, when I went to all my interviews, I could sort of reel off a few, you know, I wasn't very worldly, but at least I you know, could reel off a few names of artists and sound a lot more experienced than I was. But I think even just, you know, when you turn up to those interviews as a young, you know, high school, just leaving high school student, having just the incentive to go out and look at it is impressive to the people who are interviewing you.
Slava, I think also, when going to university at a time when, in fact, women really were just starting to go to university, it takes an awful lot of drivenness, I think, too, that you've probably have embedded in you without even realising it at that stage. I often wonder that in sculpture, and you've entered into a sort of three-dimensional kind of area, whether that was the direction you thought you might want to go in. And it's such a tough area. Sculptures in the 20th century, very much a male domain. You know, you have these huge Henry Moores, you have these pieces that are known by their heft, almost not to be the domain of females. And that changed with women like Louise Bourgeois and people who are using different sorts of materials. I'm interested to know whether, in fact, your drift to sculpture was an incidental, serendipitous thing, or how did that journey sort of happen?
Well, look, it was quite a sort of, rambling sort of journey, but it sort of began, I got into painting at, you know, at art school, and I think a lot of particularly high school age students, they end up doing painting because it's difficult in the high school setting to do anything other than, you know, painting and drawing, because it's, you know, all the OH&S considerations and just the experience of it. So I was doing painting, and I was quite a good, you know, I had quite a good natural aptitude for very realistic, you know, photoreal type painting. So I had a part-time job working for the painter John Young as one of his studio assistants. And it was a really great job as a student because, you know, most student jobs is, you know, in a kitchen
making
and
coffee.
Making coffee or, you know, something quite banal. So it was quite a great experience to work in a practicing artist in a very successful artist studio and see how everything operated. And it was enjoyable, but it started to kind of kill my own joy for painting. And there was a particular, because there were three painting assistants, there was a very particular sort of house style that we had to use, and it was very, you know, there was a definite sort of procedure. And then I'd sit down to do my own paintings and I'd sort of fall into the John Young sort of studio method, and I was just really, it was just sort of draining all the love I had out of it. So I really just thought, look, I've got to do something else to differentiate between, you know, work and my own art. And I'd always done like little craft projects, and I thought, look, why don't I, you know, start, because I didn't know anything about using, you know, tools or, you know, any of the big, you know, like, I mean, yeah, people do think in sculpture, they think of, you know, big, heavy, you know, like welding, metal, wood, you know, and at the VCA in sculpture, yes, there were, you know, having the foundry there, you know, there were like people with chainsaws, and it's amazing, you know, chainsaws and big hunks of metal and stuff. And so I just started with what I knew, which was sort of textiles and just doing little soft sculptures. And then gradually just very slowly moved towards other, you know, learning how to use all the sort of power tool repertoire. And I think part of it was too that I had to rely on other people to help me with things like that, and I found it very annoying. You know, like there was a friend of a friend who was a sculpture student who was very unreliable at, you know, and I just like, oh, I've just got to take control of this situation and learn how to use these tools. And you start with like a drill and a jigsaw, and then, you know, you gradually move up to the full, you know. And I mean, now I've got the kind of full, I've got a workshop that just about anyone would be jealous of, you know, in the tool department. So
and your choice of materials, because your work is very much about materiality. I mean, modernism is very much more about a much purer sort of formulas. It's complex and it's engaging and it's almost immersive, really. You know, how did you come upon a notion of doing, I mean, this is kind of like a diorama in a very purest sense, because we're surrounded by surface work. But when you enter into your works, you really are taking someone else. It's almost as though the outside doesn't exist. I'm curious to know about the way of it. I'm also curious to know whether, in fact, it's a reaction to a very, in the 21st century, a very sleek, modernist, the sort of art that I love, I must say, a much more pure line. Whether your art has been provoked into that because of that very minimalist kind of line, and also your use of colour, where that's come from.
Yes, yeah, well, look, I think that there was always, you know, from very early on, one thing I was very conscious of was that I tried to avoid showing things in that sort of white cube context as much as
possible, because I just sort of wanted to create a whole, you know, context for like its own world for it to exist in. And even if I was sort of showing something in the student gallery and they just gave us all plinths, you know, I'd cover the plinth in, like, you know, wood grain contact or just something to kind of differentiate it a bit and just sort of think of it as a whole experience. And I guess just because I'd always liked that experience of being transported, you know, like probably going to Europe when I was 19 was a real, you know, very influential experience of, you know, just realizing how moving into a, you know, this very immersive, complete consideration of everything, of the floors, the walls, the, you know, the roof, every single item, it can just really change things.
You know, they're saying museums, and I often say when people come to JAM, that you're unlikely to spend more than 6 to 36 seconds standing in front of an artwork. 6 to 36 seconds. And sometimes 6 seconds is way too long, because you don't have a way, you don't know how to interpret it. But when you enter your spaces, it's impossible not to be in a long time. I'm curious to know what you, if in fact you do, have a sense of what you would like a viewer to experience when they've entered into your spaces.
I guess it sort of, you know, I mean, everyone sort of brings their own sort of thing. And, I mean, some people, I mean, it's interesting because I've just had this big installation at the Johnston Collection, which, you know, as a sort of historical kind of house museum, it sort of already got its own environment than my stuff. And just talking to Louis was sort of reporting back to me on people's experiences, because I'm not there, you know, people are quite honest. And some people, they were like, I can't bear to be in this room, it's just too much. And others are like just fascinated. So you get the extremes. And I mean, I guess I always create like a sort of ideal space, you know, my ideal space. And then I just sort of hope that everyone else, you know, and people depending on, I mean, probably someone, maybe someone who grew up in like a hoarder house or something, can't, it's unbearable because it's so, you know, it's so full, there's so much going on. They're like, oh no, I, you know, whereas me in my sort of minimal house, you know, is quite like, it's like, no, I want to have, you know, everything around me and it to be very full. So, you know, so I guess, yeah, I always start from what's the sort of like craziest, in most insane space that I'd like to, you know, hang out in, and then work back from there.
And you talked about your parents having the house was never completed. How do you know when your work is completed?
I am like a terrible dead, like I respect deadlines, but I will work right up to the deadline. And so really I could just keep going forever, but It's really like, it, you know, you just sort of are told, okay, you know, like it has to be done by this date, and pretty much whatever's done by then is it, and I have to accept that. But then it's kind of nice, because if you sort of feel that you've never finished, then you just, you know, take that for the next show and you build upon it and you add something new to it.
And when Slava designed her umbrella, that's a finite kind of object. When you design a space, do you have a beginning point and an end point before you've got to the end, or does the end emerge as you're, like a novelist, you know, some novelists have the end before they've started. How does that process go for you?
Well, it really sort of, I mean, often it sort of reveals itself sort of in the installation process, because often I do a lot of things sort of site specific, and like I might, you know, say in the case of, you know, what I did at the Johnston Collection or the Rig Design Prize, I sort of put this mirror in, but I hand sort of piped the kind of frame with this acrylic gap filler product, and you can kind of just go on, you know, you can sort of, it's a bit like a goldfish, you know, like however big the pond is, it can sort of expand to fill that pond. So at the NGV, it was a huge wall, so it was able to just expand quite a lot, whereas that the Johnston Collection, it was much more limited, so it was a much smaller sort of thing. And so I sort of like to just leave, you know, like there's a certain point where it's very controlled, but it's I also like to just leave things to chance and to kind of just bring a lot of things in and then just play around in the space and sort of get the feeling for, you know, like I've sort of seen, like, there's the sort of artists who make like a model of the, you know, like almost like an architectural model of the room, and
scale models of all the artworks in it, and it's all. And I'm just not that kind of person. But I think when you work in 3D, you do get quite a good spatial sense. And you know, even when I was planning out the show I did at Craft at the end of last year, when we were just sort of planning, I just walked in and I'm like, well, this is going here and here and here. And then in the final version, everything did pretty much go where I'd imagined it. But I still, you know, I was like, well, look, it's subject to change just in relation to how everything works out. Yeah, I don't like to be too fixed and rigid in things.
And I think you're in an interesting era because women are becoming much more prominent today in the art, in the Australian. Actually, there's a fantastic article on Patricia Piccinini, the sculptor. You know, it's a long time since women have really been so prominent, I think, in that kind of area. I often think of Slava and her ballsiness, I suppose, in getting out there at an era where it was tough for women.
Mm.
I'm not sure that it's any less tough today with all our sort of fabulous attempts at trying to equalise things. Were there challenges that you would have confronted at art school and in the art world, not just being not as a sculptor, but being a woman and a sculptor?
I feel like I sort of came through at a pretty lucky time, because I sort of feel like probably up to about, you know, maybe 10 years before I went to art school, it was still sort of the bad old, you know, the lecturers kind of hitting on all the female students. And, you know, you sort of talk to an artist who's maybe 10 years older and they have these kind of horror stories. But, I mean, I had these incredibly, you know, sort of strong female lecturers in painting at the VCA, like Janine Eaton and Jan Murray, who are very, you know, like, they're not to be trifled with. And I was, and there was sort of this big influx of other, you know, contemporary female artists who came in as lecturers while I was there, and it just felt like, you know, like I never felt sort of held back in any way being a woman. Like I've never sort of felt any obvious sort of, you know, prejudice or problems in my, you know, as I've gone through as an artist, really.
And it's an absurd parallel, perhaps, maybe not inappropriate with the De Jong family and tennis, but I often think that men and women both deliver a performance at Wimbledon which is the same, and the women are always paid less.
Yeah.
Is a woman sculptor or an artist, I don't know if there's a relativity, but when you're commissioned to do work, do you think they've factored in the fact that you're a female? Does it make any difference, do you think, to your negotiations? What's that like?
I sort of haven't sort of found that myself. Like, I've sort of always found that people, you know, like often, like luckily, I guess any sort of projects that I've done, there tends to be sort of a budget, and they're like, well, look, can you deliver this for this, you know, sort of budget that we've got? And I mean, if you were quoting some outrageous price, then, you know, they just wouldn't accept, you know, like they're like, well, this is how much we're prepared to pay. So anyone has to kind of fall into line for this. But, you know, and I sort of feel like in the last couple of years, I've become a lot, you know, like there's people, people always trying to sort of negotiate things down, and I've become just a lot like, no, this is how much it is, you know, and the reason it's this much is it's a lot of, you know, time and work, and you basically just, I think it's just generally, if, you know, I don't feel I've got a very good natural business aptitude, and I've been kind of lucky that, you know, I've had sort of galleries or managers who've been quite tough on that side. And I mean, I've mostly, you know, with the exception of when I was with Callaghan Gallery in Sydney, I've always had a sort of female, you know, worked with female art dealers, or, you know, in that Pieces of Eight with Melanie Katsalidis. So I've always had these quite strong female kind of business associates as well, and you sort of just learn, like, you just sort of say, you know, well, this is what I feel it's worth, and you can accept it or not.
Which is the thing that women often don't do.
Yeah.
This is a question I would never ask of a male, and perhaps we should, a male artist. I think the greatest creative act is to probably have a child, and you have recently had a child.
Yeah.
Has that, it's not a question I would ask a male, and I don't even know why I'm asking you this, but has the act of having had a child, has that shaped, changed, made any difference to your practice and to the and the output of your work and the style of your work?
Well, I mean, look, it definitely affects the output in just in a very practical sense of it's sort of gone down, you know, it goes down quite a lot to begin with. But, it hasn't yet, but it's, you know, like there's all kinds of, I guess I sort of draw on a lot of just, you know, experiences in life to put into my artwork, and I'm sure just, you know, you have a lot of different experiences having a child, and that will kind of feed into it. And I'm sort of lucky that, you know, my partner works for himself, and it's possible for us to sort of negotiate time. Like, we're sort of quite a modern, you know, that modern sort of couple. We both work for ourselves essentially, and there's a real negotiation. It's like today, I'm like, well, I'm doing this, and I have a crazy 18-month-old sort of baby that would be climbing up on the piano and, you know, falling off the piano, so he's not coming here. And, you know, basically you've got to stay home with him. But, you know, during the week I can, you know, we can sort of look at our, you know, if I'm really busy, he can choose to, you know, sort of not schedule so much work and just have a day or two with Tristan, right. Or yeah, so it's really good in that sense. And if we didn't have that situation, I just couldn't really keep working at the level that I've been able to. So
sure, yeah. We've been talking around your work, but I know you've brought in a piece of work.
Yes.
And I wonder whether you'd like to. Oh, I don't know whether we can actually.
I could hold up a small. If you want to pass me a small one, I could sort of hold it up.
Can you talk to the work to? You've got 6 to 36 seconds to have a look at this.
It feels a bit like, you know, the auction house or something. But, all the ones I've bought in today, they're sort of part of the kind of ornament crimes collection, which, you know, it's sort of, I guess, everything you do in the sort of creative sort of life, it's all unpredictable. And so I'd sort of up until about 2010 I'd worked purely in the sort of fine art sort of sphere, and then several things sort of happened, and I ended up working with the jewelry small object gallery Pieces of Eight, and originally just doing some jewelry, but then they commissioned me to do a series of vessels. And at the time, I was sort of having a bit of a kind of quiet time, really, for a couple of reasons. But I just sort of thought, oh, well, it's a bit left field, but why don't I sort of give it a go? So the sort of original ornament crime set was seven vessels. And they're all sort of loosely inspired by, you know, by those sort of Baroque and Rococo, as well as a sort of zoomorphic quality. So most of them have little animal sort of touches. So this one's just got little sort of paws. And also it was, a lot of artists, there's certain resources, sort of books and that artists get a bit obsessed with. And Ernst Haeckel is a historical sort of natural history illustrator. And he had these drawings of sort of microscopic life form. So this particular little vase was sort of inspired by some of his engravings of I think like little amoebas and things. So it was just a combination of that sort of Rococo flourish with that natural history engraving. And I never imagined that it would sort of take off as a thing, but these sort of vessels now have been like my kind of bread and butter really for the last 5 years. And then they were in Melbourne Now, and then that led to the Ring Design Prize, and then that led to being at the Art Gallery of South Australia. So you never sort of know where anything, you know, like anything's gonna go. And I mean, again, it's if I'd been sort of too closed minded about going off on a bit of a tangent, then although, you know, those things may not have happened. So, you know, and of course it's in my sort of signature lurid colour palette.
Can everyone see it? I'm not sure they want to hang up. This is her signature lurid palette.
Yeah.
now you tend to use a lot of representations of natural life forms, but you always use synthetic materials. I think there's an interesting contradiction there.
Yes.
Is there a reason for doing that? And is it well? Is there a reason? For
well,
it?
Look, I guess because I was sort of always, you know, like I love, you know, natural history, but I guess my originally, like when I was sort of early on in my art career, I was making these sort of dioramas and things. But I was obsessed with museums and old museums, like old fusty sort of museums and the old Melbourne Museum. Again, that was one of those places that, you know, I maybe only went to a handful of times as a child, but it had this very strong impression of me. And they had those great dioramas of, you know, the lion. And I sort of was interested in that moment in natural history, the sort of perfect moment. And you only really, unless you spend a lot of time, you know, you're a National Geographic photographer or something, you know, as a general, or you're just really lucky, as a general experiencer of being out in nature, you often don't get the perfect moment, whereas the museum sort of gives it to you in, you know, but the trade-off is it's fake, you know, it's not real. And I just sort of felt like, you know, I was sort of making up all my fantastical dioramas. It just sort of felt wrong to have anything natural in it. Like it all had, you know, if it's going to be fake, it may as well be really, really fake.
And did that explain your interest in taxidermy?
Well, yes, yeah. And so, and I had this interest in taxidermy as a child, well, not as a teenager, and I actually wanted to
as you do,
you know, as a sort of, you know, bit of a, you know, kind of like emo, like teenager, and I actually wanted to do work experience with a taxidermist, and no one wanted me. You know, they were like, "No, it's not a," you know. And I wasn't sort of as bolshy as Julia DeVille to, you know, kind of. I was a bit too shy, so I was just like, "Oh, okay." And so I went and did it with a graphic designer instead, and maybe that's why I didn't end up going into design. But I sort of was interested in taxidermy, but I realised I didn't have the, you know, the guts for the guts, really. So I sort of invented my own fake taxidermy form. And I actually used this 1950s taxidermy guidebook, which had a lot of useful things just about because that was before the kind of modern fiberglass mass-produced era. And you just made your own forms using paper mache and wire and stuffing, and there was actually, like, you know, historically there was a lot more sculpture to taxidermy because, you know, you had to make your own form. And I mean, that's one of the things I love about going to those old museums is, you know, there's like these, I've seen sort of examples of, you know, the Tasmanian tiger, and it's been terribly overstuffed. It's like a little, you know, they're quite in the sort of video that they have of it, it's quite a sleek creature. And then there's this little barrel, you know, sort of barrel Tasmanian tigers, because they just had no idea what they were meant to be sort of making it to. So yeah, it used to be, I guess, much more of a sculptural art, you know, to be a good taxidermist.
And you've explored mini media and, you know, jewellery and the vessels and dioramas and installation work and painting. Have you got something that you haven't quite yet done and that you're really looking at now?
Look, there's sort of a few things. I mean, I'm quite keen on trying out some ceramics as a clay as a medium, because I used to use clay to make the original forms, and I always quite enjoyed it. But the way I used the clay to use those, they'd probably guaranteed explode into 1,000 pieces in the kiln. And I am quite interested at this point, now that I've kind of gotten my, you know, skill and tool levels up to work in some of the really, I guess, traditional sculptural mediums like bronze. And because I've done a bit of the jewellery work now, I've got a more of a sense of the lost wax sort of method. And I mean, not that I'd do it myself, but there is, I think, too, having a child, there is something a bit attractive in outsourcing certain elements and, you know, just sort of not going through the laborious mold making casting process is sort of interesting. Sure. As well.
I mean, and this is so wonderfully almost anti-technology, but you've got to use so much technology in order to achieve it, which is
yes, really, yeah.
Cool. If you were starting, over, what are the things that you think you wish you'd known now?
Look, I think I was always like really shy, and I just was never kind of wanting to ask people how to do things. And I think that there's, you know, just sort of now I'd be like, I'll just kind of get over that and ask for help, and you'd probably save a lot of time and money, and and just I guess sort of just don't be too, you know, I think I was probably a lot more in, you know, I've become, I think, more flexible over time, and I was probably a lot more sort of rigid in my thinking earlier on, and just sort of don't worry so much, just kind of go with the flow, and things just happen, you know. If you just work consistently, like, things just happen. And I mean, that's kind of you know, like a lot of people are like, oh, how, you know, like, what's the sort of magic sort of formula of making it in art? And there isn't really one, but I mean, the main thing you do is just make work, you know, just make the work, and you know, don't sort of worry so much, don't be so self-conscious about the work. There's sort of the art world's very big and broad, and there's sort of a kind of room for everyone, really. And there is an element of, you know, there are sort of trends and things, but it's sort of like, just keep doing what you're doing, and, you know, like, you'll have your sort of zeitgeist moment, and then it'll go away, and then it'll come back again. And, you know, or if you just sort of find your little spot, then yeah, just keep making the work, and don't worry about the, everything will fall into place. Yeah.
And if you're going to be collecting art or purchasing art, who would you be drawn to?
Well, look, if I had a blank checkbook and I could buy anyone, like, I've always, like, from my teenage days, I've loved Stephen Bush's paintings. And if I was a painter, and I think if I was a painter, I just would, like, want to just do his paintings, basically. Like, I just, the colour, you know, everything about them, just, you know, the sort of bizarre, you know, aspect of them, the kind of colour. They're like, but he's such a, I just think he's an amazing painter, but he also allows a lot of just random accident stuff to happen in the paint, and, you know, and I mean, often, it's quite weird, I really love a lot of abstract painters, like Lara Merritt, who I had a studio with for many years, was a great inspiration for me, and I think, actually, when I had the studio with her, her kind of palette and the way that she used colour was, I hadn't particularly been, I was quite naturalistic in the way I sort of made my little dioramas and things up to that point. And then her palette sort of rubbed off on me, and just her kind of confidence with using colour and just putting really weird combinations together and making them work.
In fact, they're almost two-dimensional version of your works, because there's this flows of colours that are going. You wonder how much of it is actually choreographed, and whether, in fact, it's happenstance that kind of just happens.
Yeah. And, I mean, just having been friends with her for many years and seeing her practice evolve and how, yeah, she's quite controlled, but also she's just let a lot of happy accidents happen. And you know, when she started using her kind of drop sheets as the artworks, you know, and I mean, because everyone would come in and say, oh, but this, you know, this drop sheet's amazing, it's an artwork in itself. And like, when she was just like, yeah, it is, actually.
Well, Einstein always said creativity is intelligence at play, so I suppose that's probably what it is. Perhaps there are some questions that you and the audience might have, which I'm sure Kate would be happy to respond to. Yes.
Have you ever gone too far? I'm a watercolour painter.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, look, yeah, the good thing, I think, about the work I do is that there is opportunity to edit if, you know, if you just feel that something's a bit excessive, or, you know. And, I often do take more... I sort of take everything, and then, you know, yeah, you sort of make decisions at the end. You're like, yeah, I will just take that bit out, or it's, you know. But yes, it is good. Like in watercolor, yeah, you basically get one shot at it, and it's over if it doesn't work out.
With your materials, do you find that some of them are toxic, and what do you do about it?
Well, look, they can be like, so I mostly use polyurethane, which is not too bad. It's kind of like, you know, using oil paint or something, that you just take precautions. Sort of being an artist is generally exposing yourself to a like any, you know, painting, sculpture, any field you work in, you're exposed to all kinds of chemicals and things. So really it's just a matter of being aware and using the protective equipment. And then I also, you know, I always have a sort of special rubbish removal service that dispose of all the containers and all the pigments and things. They, you know, it doesn't go to landfill, it gets treated and disposed of properly. So I guess it's often wonder, I think, oh, you know, I am using, you know, I'm using plastic, I'm using, you know, potentially very, you know, toxic materials. But at the same time, it's like the kind of, I keep coming back to the sort of outcome, and I'm like, oh, but I just love how they turn out. And, you know, and I think that's probably, you know, like a lot of painters too, like they really love all the, you know, the cadmium red is the best. And there's a particular, it's this kind of sort of teal, it's called cobalt teal, and it's this beautiful pigment, but again, it's very poisonous, and I'm just like, oh, but it just gives the best color, and I can't, you know, I just can't not work with it. So
how to submit?
It's just sort of something that I guess you kind of come to terms with, you know, you make your peace with it as best you can. And I mean, I guess I sort of thought, oh, maybe, you know, one of the reasons for maybe getting into ceramics is, you know, using clay. But then you think, oh, all the best glazes are really, you know, poisonous as well. And, you use all this energy to, you know, fire everything. So you can kind of go down this rabbit hole of, everything, you just sort of go down the rabbit hole. It's like you start thinking about where you get your food from, you know, I guess you try and be as conscious as you can about what you're working with, and then you know, otherwise you just sort of stay in bed or something.
There was another question there.
And the vessel you're holding, is that resin?
It is, yes. So this is, yeah, all the ones that are here are all the polyurethane resin.
Telling us how you work with resin, is it molded or?
Yeah. So all the ones here, so these are all sort of hand rotation cast. So it's a pretty basic sort of process. So there's big, you know, in industry, a lot of the plastics that we, you know, household things, that they're rotation cast, but they use a very elaborate, you know, machine system. I have a silicon mold, and it has a, you know, generally it has a fiberglass shell that's all holding it in shape. And I literally pour the resin in, and I just roll the mold around. Like, it's only got like one like this. It only has a very small opening to put the resin in, so it doesn't all run out. And, you know, and I might like say, you know, with this one, where all the colours are sort of layered, the mould is, before it's all put together, it's all open in all its pieces, and I'm just pouring little tiny amounts in, building up some interesting, you know, colour layers. Then I put the mould together, and, yeah, I'm just pouring the resin in and just rolling it around, you know, on the table or on the floor, and just kind of, you know, getting it into all the little nooks and crannies. And so it's quite a sort of random process. And you can control it to a certain extent. Like, you can sort of see that it's got this sort of pale pink at the top and then the pale blue at the bottom. And, you know, that's sort of like you've sort of focusing on just sort of holding it at a certain angle as you're doing the pouring. Sometimes I open the moulds up and I've actually missed spots, and there's little holes, or there's whole, you know, huge vast tracks that are missing. And depending on how much you've opened the mould, you can sometimes just put it back together and kind of fix it. Or otherwise you can do, you know, you can do a bit of, like any, you know, at first I used to get very anxious about that, but then I realised like every process, you know, you have to do little patch-ups. Like if you're doing bronze casting or whatever you're doing, like, you know, you've got to cut all the sprues off and sand it all back. Like, there's always finishing that needs to be done. So you can patch little holes and things up with fiberglass and just add, you know, basically the general things. Just add more resin and it'll be fine.
Are there any other... Yeah, sorry.
Oh, not at all. No, no. And look, I'm happy for people to touch the things as well.
It's wonderful how you're holding it like
yes,
a child.
Yes, it's very, you know...
Well, I can't wait to see where you're going next, actually. I think the creative process is such a mystery to all of us. And I'm not creative, and many of us envy that extraordinary gift that you've got. But I think you clearly work with such a great deal of discipline and focus. But you create things that are enchanting. I mean, they delight you. You wander, you can be in the rottenest mood and you walk into a space. And I must say, the first time I walked into a space of yours, I had that reaction. It's too much. But then you start to think, every artist is trying to say something, and you really have to give it the consideration of actually trying to look at it and give it that pay homage to the effort that you've made. And I think it's worth it. So I'm really delighted that you've been able to deconstruct your work for us in such a colourful kind of way. So please join me in thanking Kate. Yeah.
So that's it for this week's Creative Women in Conversation. Thank you to our wonderful speakers. If anyone would like to know more about the Dooldig Studio, please go to our website at www.dooldig.org.au. Thank you all very much.